6:30 a.m. in New York, 8:30 a.m. in Johannesburg, and 1:30 p.m. in Bangkok. Welcome to the Expat Happy Hour. This is Sunday Schneider Bean from sundaybean.com. I'm a solution-oriented coach and intercultural strategist for individuals and organizations. And I am on a mission to help you adapt and succeed when living abroad and get you through any life transition. I worked with a client for years on other stuff. But along the way, I watched her fiercely advocate for her son who has autism. And she did this with courage and fierceness, not only in the face of resistance, but also in another culture and language. The respect that I have for expats who are living with children who have special needs or disabilities in new cultures and languages is without end. And I have to be honest with myself. I've held this assumption, probably through the experiences I've witnessed through my clients, that living abroad with a family with special needs must be harder than staying at home. But I was soon to find out that the story isn't quite that simple. Today's podcast is about expats living with disabilities. And the reason why I'm doing this is because I feel like they are invisible in our literature, in our blogs, in our podcasts. And I want to change that. Today is a small step to increasing the level of conversation that we have about expat life and disabilities or special needs. What I'm about to share is not comprehensive in any way, nor is it without other perspectives. But what I did is start the conversation by bringing in three individuals who are impacted personally and also have professional understanding of the benefits and challenges of living abroad with family members that have disabilities or special needs. What I'll do today is I will share three stories, one from a mother of twins and her journey, a second from an expert in the field, and third is also from a family who's affected and has expertise. So let me share with you their stories, and you can see what you gain from this first step in the conversation about expats with disabilities. Now, I'm going to share a bit of Samantha Florence's story before she jumps in herself. I want to just listen for how it might sound just like yours or that of a friend that you met along the way. Samantha Florence is originally from New York City and became a third culture kid herself and expatriate at 15 when her family moved to Singapore. She was diagnosed with a profound language disability at 4.5. And her father actually was offered assignments abroad for years, but due to the quality of interventions her daughter was receiving in New York, and it didn't have an equivalent in those locations at the time, they stayed put. Due to her treatment and development, her disability became what she says, invisible. While Samantha met her husband in Singapore years later, and he is a British-French third culture kid. Everything's going along fine until Samantha was 7.5 months pregnant with her son, and she suddenly had a moment of panic. It occurred to her that she could pass on her disability to him, and it was terrifying her. Her husband reminded her that if her son inherited disability, it would be very different for him because he would have a parent who'd been there before and could guide him through it. Samantha went on to have two children, 13 months apart, but who act more like twins. They had their own language and rarely spoke English to her or to anyone else, but they started speaking English as soon as they started attending preschool at a school in Bali. The family spent a year in Bali, and by the time they left, the children were 4.5 and 3.5 and were nearly fluent in Bahasa Indonesia, and they'd also picked up some Balinese. I mean, how proud would you be as parents if your children were nearly fluent in the local language? The family then spent the next 18 months in Kuala Lumpur. At that time, there were so many expatriates that really no spots were available at the international school. So they ended up spending their time at the Waldorf school, where they were exposed now to Bahasa Melayu, I'm sorry if I'm saying that wrong, and Mandarin Chinese, but there was no pre-literacy and pre-numeracy instruction. They moved to the San Francisco Bay Area with a six-year-old and a five-year-old who had American passports but knew nothing about American life, and they spoke Malaysian English, right? So there are some of you who are listening, they're like, oh, that's perfect, right? They've got Malaysian English. They're ready to go. Samantha knew that without any previous exposure to the alphabet or numbers, her son would have a tough time. So they sent the children to a French preschool program in the mornings, and they had their children meet with a language learning specialist to support them on literacy and numeracy. Both children worked hard and learned quickly. They had a lot of ground to cover, but by the time they left the Bay Area, her son was only a couple months behind his peers, and the daughter was a few months ahead. They felt their children were in a strong position to transition to a public school. So far, when you listen to this, this is clearly reminiscent of a globally mobile life, right? Maybe switch the country out for another one. But what was about to happen was something Samantha had never expected. They moved to a wealthy school district with a stellar reputation just out of Philadelphia in the United States. And everything went wrong. Samantha had explained that culture shock was a real concern for her to the school, and that both of her children had an unusual ESL profile, and that some support would be helpful. She says that although the school staff had said all the right things at the time, she later discovered that almost no one working with them was informed of these things. Unfortunately, Samantha noticed a severe regression in her children's reading and language skills, and things went even further downhill from there. So staff was pressuring for tests for autism, and they were missing signs of depression and anxiety, let alone the causes of what were causing that at the school. The evaluations done at the school district were uninformed of the TCK experience, nor was the staff professionally qualified to diagnose the children with what the children were struggling with, as it was so outside their domestic experience. The children were not getting the IEPs that they needed, and their regression in all academic areas, including language, accelerated. So the IEPs are these individualized learning profiles that they needed, were just not happening. So what Samantha noticed is that trouble at school continued, and the family decided to pay for a qualified independent evaluator who diagnosed the children with adjustment disorder with features of anxiety caused by the school environment. AD it's more commonly known as situational depression by us lay people that are listening. And the specialist said that the children's learning profile was consistent with non-native students who had learned English through immersion and did not have a full formal grounding of the basics. Samantha, I have been telling your story, and now here you are to tell us more. I just want to say thank you for being here, because I know that you've been through so much, and I know this isn't the end of the story. So tell us more. Your story is probably one that frightens parents who wonder what kind of impact their time abroad could have on their children. It might raise questions. So tell us, what is it? What advice do you have, with the benefit of hindsight, that you wish you had known earlier?
The two things I wish I had known earlier is I wish I had known to look for the special needs parenting group in my area before choosing a place to live. There's a lot of information about school district rankings provided, both online and offline, and these can be great resources. But these rankings tend to reflect the experiences of more typical students. So what I didn't know was that coming in with such a different experience, these rankings and shared family testimonies of what their experiences were like would not apply to us at all. Whereas special needs parenting groups have a lot of information on which school districts will collaborate with parents and which ones will take a much more adversarial stance. And I wish I had known to look for and reach out to that group before considering where I was going to live and where I would send my children to school.
You know, what you say is so important. And I, it actually makes me think of any expat family, because our experiences are out of the norm. So when you go back to, let's say, you know, quote, your home country or to a new location, if those children in the school do not have experiences that match your own, whether it is a child with a disability or not, that knowing of, is this school prepared to handle my child's unique background? It's such a great question. What I'm hearing you say is even more important if you do have a child with special needs, because the parents who are living it and dealing with the school system are going to be able to tell a story that's different than what's going to be on their shiny website.
So our school district has a very high ranking both in our state and nationally. And they are able to provide a lot of services with full-time employees that many school districts either can't provide at all, or if they do provide them, they can only provide them part-time. They have full-time school psychologists, speech and language pathologists, occupational therapists, ESL specialists, and probably even more specialists, which, because I haven't had to deal with them, I just can't think of them off the top of my head. So on paper, they looked like such a great choice for a family that might need some help during the transitionary period. But what I didn't know is that our district does not have a good reputation with special needs parents in our area. They're known for not taking what parents tell them about their children at face value, and they go to due process against families a lot. Due process is a special arbitration process for educational disputes. So it's adjudicated by a due processor who's not a judge, and it's subject to some different rules. And I did not know before I moved here that our school district takes families to due process a lot.
And okay, so that would have prepared you to make maybe a different decision or prepare differently for your time. What was the other thing? You said there were two things. The first one was to look for special needs families in their area. What was the second thing that you wish you had known?
The second thing I would have done, so we're represented by an advocate and an educational consultant, which this is a job that does not exist in any other country that I've heard of. And the woman who's our advocate is named Maria Vetter, and she used to be a special education teacher. And she helps families in showing up in independent education plan meetings, but she can also give them advice on school districts and private schools that might be a good match for their child's profile. And I wish I had known to reach out to someone like her before moving here, because her advice would have been really useful. And she's told me that other families moving to the United States are free to contact her, and she would help them find someone in the area that they're moving to, because she's a member of a professional body and she can use that to find someone.
Okay, so for those, it's an advocate and an education consultant. And if you're not from, let's say, the US, look for an equivalent in your home country. They might have specialists that could be neutral advisors to help you with the transition process. So that's great advice right there. So you've gone through so much, and that's one thing you said you wish you had known. What are you most proud of
in terms of what did you do that you're proud of that you could share with other families who are in equally challenging situations?
What I'm most proud of is going into these meetings and communicating our story and what our needs were without yelling or cursing at anyone, because this can be an extremely confrontational process, especially when you have a school district who is more or less saying, wow, your story is so interesting. I'm going to pat you on the head and ignore everything you've just said. And it really doesn't feel good when they do that. But I feel good about the fact that we've been consistent in our message the whole time without turning into a rage demon. Even though that would have felt satisfying at times, it would have undermined what we were trying to do.
Well, and if anybody listening, I mean, we all want to protect our children like we're rabid tigers, right? So when our, I totally get that. So the fact that you were able to do that is a monumental feat when you feel like, you know, the things that you've gone through and the hardships your children have experienced, you feel so vulnerable as a parent. How did you do that? How did you keep it together? And how were you able to, one, be consistent in your message, and two, not let your emotions throw off your communication?
Well, my husband is really supportive, and we would talk about it together at home and get all of those ugly feelings and curse words out at home where our kids couldn't hear us. So I feel like that helped, that we were on the same page and we could use the bad words, but also learning about the protections afforded under federal law and understanding that better helped me frame that message. Because what's interesting about the United States is we have some really robust protections at the federal level for children with disabilities, but enforcement and compliance at the local level is incredibly patchy. So understanding what those federal rights were and talking about them in meetings really was helpful.
Okay, so this is this, you know, when I'm listening to this, I already feel overwhelmed, to be honest. Like, I'm a parent. I have to go through transitions. I've got my own business, my own life thing happening. And then I'm hearing on top of that, as a family of a globally mobile family like yourself, on top of that, you have to understand the federal level of protection for your child. And you're talking about the US, but for other families, it's, you know, other countries and other regions. And you need to understand how can you have that properly enforced at the local level. How did you do that?
Well, sometimes you end up actually reading legislation, or you're reading guidance. Like, for instance, we've read guidance for staff members at both the Federal Department of Education and our State Department of Education to try to understand the backdrop against which this was all occurring. I expected the legislation to be written in much more difficult to understand language, but surprisingly, it wasn't. So I was pleasantly surprised by how approachable it was.
Okay, so don't be afraid to reach out and read the legislation and the guidance that's available. What is the role of others in your community? Because I have a hunch, you know, you've done this and now you have all this wisdom to share. Other families have done this. Who do you, where's your pool of support or knowledge, so you don't always have to recreate the wheel?
Right. So what's been really interesting is for a long time, I felt really uncomfortable with the idea of joining the special needs parents group in our community. I felt really embarrassed by the fact that my children weren't born with a disability. So I felt as if our situation is so minor compared to the lifelong struggle of other parents whose children were maybe born with, let's say, autism or Down syndrome. And I let that make me delay joining the group. But once I did join the group, those parents of children who were born with disabilities were a real font of wisdom for me. And I then realized that even though my children weren't born with a disability, because we were dealing with the same people and the same process, that their experiences were applicable to ours, even though the cause was different.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Gosh, that is really great for you to share that.
So that I would just say, don't feel embarrassed that, because I did feel embarrassed. I felt, what do I have in common with someone whose child was born with autism and has severe sensory processing disorder? And then I realized it's actually more than I thought.
Right. And now you're part of that community and you're able to support each other. That's great. So I'm hearing reach out to people who are in the same boat, or explore, maybe see if you're in the same boat, then you don't perceive it from the beginning is what I'm hearing.
Right.
Because finding a champion for your kids if they have special needs varies based on the gravity of what they're dealing with. But in the end, what I'm hearing you say, it's still fighting and advocating for your kids.
Right. Also, the independent evaluator really made the effort to learn about third culture kids, even though she had not worked with them before. And that has been a really great help. And
so did she learn, can I ask something, did she learn about it on her own, or did you have to educate her?
I educated her in the beginning, but I was able to point her towards the resources that would help her educate herself. Mm-hmm. So through the group I Am a Triangle, I had seen people talking about which, you know, the Third Culture Kid Bible or which other resources are helpful to read. So I was able to point her in the right direction.
Right. So this is, I always find that, you know, when people who are living with third culture kids, because I'm such a nerdy interculturalist, I'm always surprised that not everybody carries this third culture kid book around with them everywhere. So I love that you mentioned that. Right. That for those of you who are listening and have kids that are being raised outside of your own passport culture, there is a wonderful book called Third Culture Kids from the Pollock family and Ruth, I want to say Vandenberg, Ruth von Rankin. That is exactly, that is wonderful. So the Third Culture Kid group is wonderful. Naomi Hadaway's I Am a Triangle is a great resource for a specialized group where you can ask questions which families are dealing with similar issues. So those are two resources that you can go to if you're listening to this. So we've looked at what you're proud of. You have been able to reach out to a community and allow yourself to learn and see how you're similar and different. You've got experts that are helping you along the way. It looks like you and your partner are on the same page.
Right.
If you look back, there's a lot that you did right. If other families are feeling frustrated and you've gone through, you've had some successful strategies, I'm sure if you're human, you've had some things that you've tried that weren't very successful. What could you recommend to other families so that their story isn't quite as long and quite as emotional as yours?
I would love to say that there's something I can recommend that would prevent this, but that really depends on your school district and their attitude towards outside opinions. Some are more open to new experiences and outside opinions than others. And because I got an advocate involved so early, I've been lucky to avoid unsuccessful strategies for the most part. And and it's because of previous knowledge that I had that I got both an advocate and a special education attorney involved so early. So every time I might have pursued an unsuccessful strategy, they would steer me back on track. They would say things like, well, under the law, you can't ask for that at this time. Or so I feel as if finding an advocate and or a special education attorney early definitely helps you avoid asking for something in the wrong way that ends up disqualifying you from a certain benefit forever.
So what I'm hearing, one, the overarching theme is don't do it alone.
Yes.
That means seek out the advice of advocates or experts. I'm hearing, you know, get involved with a community of people who are dealing with the struggles. Let's see if their school district are getting their needs for a fair and appropriate education for their kids met. I'm hearing also, you know, be aware when you're looking for a school district for your kids that they're open to experiences are outside the norm of what their school might be, like third culture kid experiences, and that they are open to outside opinions.
Right. Because I had a friend whose children showed up with a very similar profile to mine. They were experiencing severe culture shock, and they spoke English with an Asian speech pattern that was nearly identical to mine. And they were living about 20 minutes away from me in a different school district. And this school district ended up setting up a diversity committee with parents of all different experiences and backgrounds, where the mission of that committee was to talk about how to make the school environment more welcoming and inviting. And their speech and language pathologist, upon learning that the children's speech pattern was typical in their previous country of residence, said, well, I'm not going to pathologize them for speaking a different dialect, and then didn't diagnose them with a language problem. So it really can vary that much.
Wow. And so that gives me chills on my arms. So that was my actually next question is, what advice do you have, you know, for organizations that serve global families or maybe don't serve global families regularly, but find themselves in that situation? Anybody in a school district, you know, a speech pathologist, anybody in the international school system or in domestic schools that have international kids come from time to time, what advice would you give them?
I really think we need something that educates local schools, especially public schools, on the challenges that third culture kids face when entering a community where they are really in the minority. My advocate said something very interesting to me, in that our case had been very interesting to her because we were the first third culture family she had come across, but in doing the research and applying it to her previous understanding of education law, she had realized that the families who are globally mobile, we are extremely vulnerable to FAPE violations, meaning our children can fall through the cracks and not receive appropriate public education just because the schools are unfamiliar with what the needs are when we first show up.
And sorry, just so the others who are listening don't know, that FAPE is free and appropriate public education as defined in the U.S. So that's just clarifying for the audience. Right. And that applies for other national level school programs, right? What does that nation define as appropriate education?
Right.
And like also, you said, we're vulnerable.
Right. Although the A for appropriate is unique to the United States. Just about everywhere else, it's free public education. But if they, at a certain point, if they can't meet your needs, you're up the creek without a paddle and you have to find an alternative on your own. Whereas in the United States, if they can't meet your child's needs and they've been trying and you've been trying, then they still have to provide an education, even if it's not within the school district's programming. And that's a big difference.
So it makes me wonder, for those who are living in other nations, or will repatriate one day to a country that is just about free public education, do you advise that these families start thinking about saving for private education in case a public school system can't meet their children's needs?
I would strongly consider that. I would also strongly consider, ooh, if I'm paying for private school, maybe I need to live somewhere that's a little bit less expensive. You know, because mm-hmm. we chose to live quite close to the city of Philadelphia because mm-hmm. we thought that that proximity to the city and my husband's then job would be really great. But if we had known, ooh, okay, maybe we're in a situation where no public school district could meet our needs and we should go private, we could have chosen somewhere further away where our rent money would have gone further.
Right. So it's really looking at if you are going to settle in an area where you have a child with special needs and you don't have the full confidence that the public school system is going to meet those needs, to make your choices in a way that prepares you to provide support independently, which is unfortunate because all of us want our kids' needs to get met.
Right.
Just no matter what, right? That's a hard reckoning, I think, to come with, but it's a very proactive approach. We talked about, you know, where you were at that point where you just found out this specialist actually validated what you'd been saying the whole time, that it was your kids had learned English through this immersion and that's what was coming up. Unfortunately, by that time, there was some implications. You were talking about that in 2017, 2018. The kids were making great progress, but this up and down had an impact on your kids and how they saw their own achievement. Do you mind what has happened in, let's say, 2017 up to now? Bring us up to date. Where are you now and how are your kids doing?
Okay, well, starting in 2017, my children started receiving something called homebound instruction, which is when a school district provides a private tutor to instruct your children in the home because they have a medical need that prevents them from attending school in the building. And this can be something like a broken pelvis or chronic fatigue syndrome. Or in our case, it was the adjustment disorder with features of anxiety caused by the school environment. But this was very difficult for us to get because, and here's the part where I read state legislation on homebound instruction specifically mentions that a psychological, mental, emotional health condition is grounds for homebound instruction, and that a certified mental health professional can write a prescription for homebound instruction. But our school district's policy states that it must be written by a physician. So our physician tried to write the prescription for homebound instruction, but he doesn't have the grounding in mental health. So he didn't write it in a way which they felt satisfied their requirements. So we were denied. We then had the independent evaluator, who's a neuropsychologist, write it. And even though she went into more detail, they denied it because she wasn't an MD. Mm-hmm. So that I said to them at the time, state law says that she can write this prescription. And my lawyer had to say to me, Samantha, your understanding of the law is correct, but you would spend a lot of time and money fighting in court to get them to recognize this when it would really just be easier for you to get your MD to endorse what your neuropsychologist is saying. So I had to give my children's physician and neuropsychologists permission to talk to each other because there's a lot of rules around patient confidentiality here. Mm-hmm. and they spoke to each other. And my children's physician basically wrote a letter saying, I'm a doctor and I support her diagnosis. But then that was denied because the school said, well, he's just endorsing what she's saying. He's not writing his own diagnosis. And because we hadn't been sending our children to school at this time, they started truancy proceedings against us.
Oh, so this fight is definitely not over. And I hear that some of the mistakes that were made along the way have permanently impacted your family on so many levels. And what I'm also hearing, it's one of the reasons why I want you to share your story, because if anyone who's listening is in a position of influence or understanding the implications of a child with special needs combined with a third culture kid experience, how that makes it more complex. These kids could have thrived quickly in a school if it had the right staff working in the right way with the right, let's say, diagnosis sooner. Right.
I really feel that there's no reason that my children could not have thrived in public school if they had taken what we said at face value in the beginning and worked with us.
I'm going to repeat that. Take what these global families say at face value, even if it doesn't fit in to an experience that you can identify with.
Right, because I was very upfront in the beginning because both my husband and I are third culture kids ourselves. So we have that experience of making those transitions ourselves as children and being able to talk about what that feels like along with the parenting angle and who our children are and what they've experienced.
Yeah. So Samantha, I just want to say thank you so much for taking the time to share your story. And for, I know you're doing it for families out there who are going through equally complex and frustrating battles. So I really wish you all the best in your next steps. There was something, if you don't mind, Samantha, I'm going to share with our audience. In an email to me, Samantha said, I see my children getting stronger and more confident every day, and I'm thrilled by the progress they're making. But I know that the future ahead of them is not the one we had planned for them. As happy that I am that we are on the path to things getting better, I still find myself frustrated that we had to fight so hard and spend so much money to make that possible. So my hope, Samantha, is that by you sharing your story, that you can help other parents stop the amount of time and the fierceness of which they have to fight.
I really hope so too.
Yeah. Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
What we see from Samantha's story is that the quality and timing of support from schools is absolutely essential. What I'm also taking away is the importance of parents informing themselves. Unfortunately, the burden of gaining this knowledge on their shoulders, but also seeking professional help and being a translator of the law and their children for the schools. Likewise, I'm hearing a call to those in similar institutions who may not be quite as familiar with global kids to work hard to take what parents and their children say at face value. So because of this, I asked Stephanie Sexton, who has an MA in special ed, and she is also a mother of four children, all of which have had some level of service during their 6 years abroad, to tell us what she thinks can be done to support this experience. Remember, we talked about these individualized learning or education plans. Here's what she said about the challenges and current limitations of them.
Every family who has lived abroad understands the many unique challenges we face. For families with children who acquire learning support services, however, the challenges become more complicated. One particular stress is accessing quality-appropriate education. International schools are often impressive with the facilities, resources, and staff. They can also be fairly limiting as to their clientele, especially when a child requires learning support services. In the U.S., all children are guaranteed a free, appropriate public education. The Individualized Education Plan, or in international schools, they might refer to it as an ILP, Individualized Learning Plan, or a Learning Support Plan. It all refers to the same thing. I'm going to call it an IEP. And this helps to regulate and mandate academic, social, or behavioral supports for children who qualify because they cannot access a curriculum without some level of intervention. While most reputable international schools have the resources to meet most mild to moderate and often beyond specialized learning needs, unfortunately, the IEP is commonly written in a way that caters to the current school and its capabilities rather than to the specification of the child's strength, challenges, and necessary supports. This is one of the greatest challenges expat families with special needs children face during transition season. Schools receiving IEPs from new families rely on the IEP to summarize the child's strengths, challenges, and needs in the classroom. If those aren't clearly established, new schools are left to interpret the data and information solely based on admission paperwork, which truthfully too often does not give an accurate portrayal of the child's. Parents can become their child's strongest advocate by attending IEP meetings that should be held once or twice a year or upon parent request. The IEP should be written clearly and simply with a focus on facts, highlighting test data, summative and formative reports, as well as the child's goals and progress towards the goals are important. Listing the supports in place the child requires to adequately access the curriculum is also important, but this is where it can get complicated. Schools need to stick to the basics here of what supports are effective and not get overly specialized concerning what their school can provide. The narrative portion of the IEP can offer the details and helpful information or tips the current school has found to be beneficial. This is the area where more subjective information can be listed. Clearly establishing the needs of the child in a clear, concise manner will eliminate guesswork. The receiving school must have an accurate understanding of the child's baseline needs to establish whether or not they can meet those needs. Certainly, one does not want their child to transition into a program that can't accommodate them. But alternatively, we don't want a child rejected solely because of a misrepresentation on paper. Parents can ask the school to review IEPs before transition. I imagine 3 to 6 months prior would be ideal, so the facts are up to date and accurately represented. Further, professional consultants can review IEPs to try to help to establish non-bias and concise understanding of the designated educational reports.
We see here that the best of intentions of offering very specialized recommendations might actually backfire and make a transition harder. And that, again, we hear parental involvement and advocacy is key. So far, we've talked about the challenges and how parents and institutions can minimize the struggles that families face. Next, you'll hear from Kathy Silva, where she highlights actually the benefits of living abroad with special needs. Kathy Silva is a diplomatic spouse with autistic spectrum twins and a neurotypical daughter. Her family is now living in their 7th country, and she gladly promotes the benefits of living abroad with special needs. So much that she is currently working on a book that is filled with inspiring personal essays on the topic. Here's Kathy sharing her story.
I'm a love pat. I met my husband while I was doing a year volunteer in Ecuador, and he's Ecuadorian, and we moved back to the States originally so we could learn English, and then we joined the Foreign Service about 16 years ago. I have 3 kids. My oldest are twins. They're 17, and they're the ones that are on the autism spectrum. And so when we joined the Foreign Service, they weren't diagnosed, but they were preemies, and they had lots of just developmental delays, but they were only a year and a half at the time, so we didn't really know. So we went to our first posting in Paris, which is they cleared us for Paris because they thought there would be good services for developmental needs there. While we were in Paris, they were diagnosed with autism. And we also realized how inadequate the services in Paris were. So we curtailed back to this, back to DC, did all sorts of really intensive therapies. And that's where I spent a lot of time doing research on autism and different approaches and things. And my daughter was born there. And then we went overseas to South Africa after that. So my twins were 5 and my daughter was a year and a half. And we've been overseas since.
I'm going to be provocative here. Now, there are some people who are totally unaware of families living with disabilities. And there might be someone who's saying, why would you move abroad when you know your kid has special needs?
Well, first of all, we do a ton of research before we go anywhere to make sure that wherever we're going has adequate or more than adequate services for what we need. We have felt that there's been incredible advantages to being overseas. Most of the time, for example, we can afford household help so that instead of me spending so much time washing dishes and doing laundry, I can actually be interacting with my kids and or taking them to therapies or, you know, doing what I need to be there for my kids. Sometimes overseas, my son put it in a really good way. He's very insightful, and he says, when we're overseas, Mom, people see us as different because we're not from their country, but not different because we have a disability. And so they're curious about us, but they don't judge us necessarily right away. And they're a little bit more open-minded to accept us as being different because they see us as foreigners first.
Wow.
And I think that's
what does that say about society right there? That is so powerful.
Yeah. Well, I think it would be the same anywhere. Even in the States, I would imagine that if somebody came in with, for example, my twins, one of the problems that comes with their autism is they have a very slow processing. So they think just fine, but just much slower than the rest of us. So when somebody asks them a question, it takes them an extra just couple of seconds to respond. But in the States, because they speak English, if they don't get a response right away from my twins, they think that they're being rude or they're not paying attention. And so they'll repeat the question again, which just gets my twins all even more confused because then they're listening to the second question, thinking it's a new question. When we're overseas, it's different. And then I think even in the States, so if you're dealing with somebody that doesn't speak English as a first language, you tend to be a little bit more patient with them. So that's just, that's just an example of, I think overall, yeah, people just tend to be more patient and understanding with someone if they accept the differences, right?
And I love that you shared right away at the top the benefits of living abroad because, I am the first person to say that living abroad is such a growth experience and a tough and
it absolutely
a positive
is.
Experience. And what absolutely. I'm hearing you say is, you know, families, if you're thinking about moving abroad, if you have a child with some sort of disability, this could actually be an opportunity. This could actually be an advantage.
Definitely for us, there's been advantages. Yeah.
That's and great to hear.
The other thing about being abroad is that it makes the families grow closer because they have to rely on one another. And so for our whole family, it's been beneficial in that way. And my daughter has become closer with her brothers. And in our sense, another part of the autism is just this issue of not opening up to other people and kind of being in your own world. And it's been really good for our family because it's really forced the twins to open up a bit more with us because they really need us because we're in strange situations a lot.
I am so grateful for the families in our own school that are there who have children, let's say with autism or living with some disability, because I feel like that helps my child see there are so many ways of being in the world. There are so many ways of learning and our needs vary and we can all find a way to do this thing together, right? I just am so grateful to the families that are in our community, for example, because I feel like it helps kids see the spectrum of ways of being in the world and it gives them permission to be in the world the way that they are as well.
Absolutely. And that's one of the things that I've been a big advocate for is increasing the diversity of learning differences in international schools, because up until recently, there has been very little opportunity for kids with special needs to be accepted into international schools, especially in the upper grades. In the elementary school, the international schools tend to do a pretty good job of accepting the kids and then accommodating them. But once you get into secondary school, the options are extremely limited. And that's been a real challenge for us as my twins are now 17. So they're in 11th grade. So the past two or three schools we've had to look for, we've had to really push and promote the advantage of having kids with learning differences at their school. And it has not been easy.
In fact, so what do you think, what do you wish you could tell international schools or organizations that are sending families abroad that they don't maybe know now or don't get? What message would you love to tell them?
Well, for international schools, what I try to tell them is how important, because the world is changing. The reality is there's a lot more diagnoses of kids with autism or with learning disabilities. And it's becoming almost the new norm to have a certain percentage of the population in this category. And the international schools can't function. They can't keep going with the old model, assuming that all kids can learn the way the traditional schools are teaching them. It's important for them to start opening their minds a little bit more and seeing that learning disabilities does not mean that they're necessarily going to bring the scores down of the international schools or bring their reputation down. A lot of the international schools too make a big effort to do community service and go out and. For example, the school that we were just at in Uruguay, they had a really big program where they would go out and take the kids from our international school to go to a school for kids with special needs. And they did it once a semester and it was a really big deal. And I told them, why do you have to make a big deal out of it and make it a one-day thing when you can have kids in the actual school itself and the other students can interact with them on a day-to-day basis? And how much more enriching is that than just to go one day a semester and have this, you know, short interaction that then you forget about it a couple weeks later. Right. So,
totally. Even when you're talking, I'm getting kind of triggered. Like when I hear this idea, and maybe I'm wrong because this is not my area, but when I hear, you know, a learning disability, what I hear is children with different learning abilities, right? Like, why is there even a judgment around that? Because we are diverse. We have multiple needs that, yes, there might be what's called mainstream because of just statistics, but it kind of makes me mad on the inside of why is there that judgment? And that's what I'm hearing from you. Why is this one special day rather than integrated into the everyday? And I do think the school that my kids are going to have that sort of, you know, norm of this is just everyday life and this is how we do it.
Right. Right. And the kids need to get used to that because Like I said, yeah, it is the new norm. And when they get out into the real world, they're going to be dealing with people in the workplace that might be a bit quirky or that might need a little bit more processing time to respond or, it's the best thing we can do is expose them to it now.
Well, and who is better prepared to be adaptive in their approach than people who are living international lives, right? We are adaptive to different cultures, behaviors, customs, languages. We as an international community are perfectly poised to do that when it comes to learning and connecting with people who have various approaches to learning. Mm-hmm. Right? So there's so much potential there. What do you think? So we talked about what international schools could do. What about organizations who are sending families abroad? Like, oh, I don't know. Maybe this family won't thrive because it's harder. What would you say to them?
Well, interestingly, there's a big debate going on right now in the State Department because there's been, whereas in the past, the medical office there has been very flexible about allowing families with all sorts of special needs to go overseas as long as we can prove that we can find the resources that we need. That's been changing in the past, say, 5 years or so, and they're really, within the State Department, making it difficult for families with special needs to be overseas. And many of us who have had amazing experiences overseas are putting up a big fight about it. We think that's the completely wrong direction to go in. There are a lot of resources out there, and I think that it's wrong to believe that the United States is the best place for special needs. We have had incredibly good help and good therapists in other countries and different approaches that the U.S. doesn't see, but they work just fine or they work even better. I think, too, so much of it depends on the lifestyle. For example, in the States, the public schools, even though they do offer free therapies and things like that, overseas, you may have to pay for it. But in the States, life is very stressful. People are rushed. There's this common push to be better than your neighbor or do more or, you know, be the best. Sometimes in the States, just that slow-paced lifestyle really makes a huge difference and in the quality of life for the kids and the value of the interactions that they have with people. There may be, for example, in Uruguay, where we were just living before here, there wasn't a whole lot of education necessarily about autism. People didn't really know much about it, but they were so kind and curious and thoughtful that the interactions that my twins had with the people there were actually so much better than a lot of interactions they had with professionals in the States that had been trained in autism treatments and therapies.
So what I'm hearing if whoever's listening and you are part of a sending organization, whether you work for a government, an NGO, or a corporate entity, a mission abroad, that if your intention is to protect a family by keeping them local, you might actually be doing them a disservice because the reality is that many families have gone abroad and thrived even more than being home local because they were able to have access to support that wasn't affordable in their home country. Their children are seen in more complex ways and that the connection with locals might be more rewarding and grounding than even in their home country. So I think that's a bias that needs to be broken. So yep. Thank you for sharing that.
Yep. You said it perfectly.
Are there other biases out there, whether it's from an organization or from, you know, families like me who do not have kids with a disability? Is there a bias out there that you think that people need to know about?
No, I think the main bias is to just assume that you're best off in your home country. Mm-hmm. especially in the United States. The United States has amazing medical care, amazing research facilities, but so do other countries, and we shouldn't discount that.
So what advice would you give for a family who's either just setting off abroad or find themselves, you know, in their early years of living abroad and someone in their family is living with a disability or special needs? What advice do you have? You know, I'm sure you've made some wise decisions along the way. Maybe you've made some mistakes along the way. How can we learn from your wisdom?
Well, definitely do your research, because not all overseas experiences end up being successful. You just got to really do your research, try to get involved in as many Facebook groups with the disability, or just, you know, make networks, talk to as many people as you can on the ground. You get to get firsthand experiences. Don't ever assume. A lot of people assume, for example, that Western Europe is a really good place to be for certain special needs. Mm-hmm. It's not true. We had our worst experience of all was in Western Europe. That was where we got the worst care. And when we found out that the education about autism was actually much further behind than, say, Africa or South America. So don't ever assume something. Don't assume that just because it's a developed country that it's going to have good services, and an undeveloped country will not have good services.
Great, great, right there. Wonderful. So this assumption that they might have. So any family who is thinking, oh, it's safer to be, let's say, in Western Europe because they have more developed services, that might not be true. So to do your research, check out the networks. Kathy, after this, I'm going to ask you if you have any recommendations, and I'll put them in the blog as well for people who are interested. So you and I have talked about the things you need to do to prepare. What I'm hearing is research is your number one tool to be successful. I'm hearing that your community around you, finding ways to find support that work your family, that support your family, is a way to go. I'm also hearing being really clear with your sending organization that the research supports that the families can thrive abroad, even if a family member is dealing with special needs. Anything else that mm-hmm. you feel like families who are you know, living with special needs need to know to look forward to their time?
Yeah, I would say make sure that you're very open and honest with your sending organization. Don't keep anything a secret because you're afraid you're not going to get the position or they're not going to send you to the country you want to go to. Honesty up front is essential. Absolutely essential. I've heard horror stories of people that figure, oh, well, we won't tell them, but once we get there, we'll sort it all out. And then it ends up being a disaster. It's unfair for the whole family. It's unfair for the organization. So be honest and upfront in the beginning.
Great.
And the same with schools. Just be completely honest. I would rather the school know everything and tell me, no, they can't support me, than to get there and then find out that that's the case.
Great. Good to know. And so what's going on with you? What projects do you have ahead in the future that are related to supporting families with special needs?
Well, I'm in the process of working on a book. I've talked to many families dealing with all sorts of special needs, or adults dealing with special needs, the parents of children with special needs, and experts in the field of special needs. But they're all expats. That's what they all have in common. And so I'm collecting personal essays about what their stories are, what's been good, what's been bad, and then putting it together in a book.
Ooh, exciting. And when can we look forward to your book, Kathy?
Oh, let's see.
By the way, Kathy is speaking to me from which country again?
I'm in Uganda right now.
Your container arrived yesterday. This woman is so generous. She's on the phone with me right now. 24 hours after her container arrived, right? So let's not put her under pressure to say a date for the book, but I know everybody is looking forward to it. And when you do publish it, I want me to be one of the first people you tell so I can share it with the community.
After our call, Kathy emphasized the importance of not relying only on experts to tell you if a location has the services you need. She says in organizations, there may be decision-making from people who represent a region, but don't actually get to travel often enough to truly be on the ground and know what's available. She recommends do your own research. She ended by saying that she is a true believer in knowing exactly what you're dealing with before going overseas. She says, I'm forever grateful for the 2 years I spent back in my home country doing hardcore early intervention and learning everything I could about autism resources and treatments before I was comfortable going overseas with my twins. I had an open mind and was willing to try new things abroad, but I went through with thorough knowledge of what to do and how I could continue to research what my children needed, no matter where we are. So what I take away from this is the absolute need to empower yourself if you're responsible of children with disabilities. And so far in this podcast, we've only talked about being parents of children with special needs. But some of you who are listening might be an expat yourself and have special needs or be living with a disability. I am no expert, but I believe the same applies. Unfortunately, the onus is on you to get informed and educate organizations. At the same time, I want to say, hey, if you are responsible for sending employees abroad, then it is also your responsibility to get savvy on your people who are living with disabilities, because what we've learned from the interviews that it, you might actually have an employee who thrives better abroad than in their home country. And with the right information and support, you can do your organization the best service for performance by supporting them in the ways that are specific to their needs. I know this topic is complex and that what I've shared here is just a small taste of the breadth and depth of global families with members who are living and thriving with disabilities. I know it is just beginning to open the conversation of what an organization needs to do to be insightful about the people they are serving and sending. But please, this is a start of a conversation. And now it's your turn. Talk to your schools. Talk to the families in your community who are living with disabilities. Talk to your employees who say they need special needs. It's up to us to open up the conversation in our community and in our organizations and in our families about the real challenges and real benefits of working and living abroad with loved ones who have special needs or live with disabilities. This is Sunday Chandra Bean, and you've been listening to Expat Happy Hour. Thank you for being here. I will leave you with the words of the iconic American actor Christopher Reeve, best known for his portrayal of Superman, and whom was left quadriplegic after being thrown from a horse during an equestrian competition. A hero is an ordinary individual who finds the strength to persevere and endure in spite of overwhelming obstacles.